Welcome to the Proper Mental Podcast. Normalizing open and honest conversations about mental health by having open and honest conversations about mental health. Hello and welcome to Proper Mental Podcast episode 183 with Mark McGowan, who is an artist, a taxi driver, an educator and a speaker who is more commonly known as the Artist Taxi Driver. And Mark discovered art as part of his recovery from addiction and mental health issues when he was an inpatient in hospital. And he uses the media, activism and mental health to create daily artworks. And Mark's form of performance art over the years has included things like eating a swan in protest against royalty and the upper classes. He once attempted to cartwheel 60 miles along Brighton Beach in protest against diminishing coastlines. And he's crawled for 60 miles with a rose between his teeth, 18 boxes of chocolates tied to him and a sign on his back saying, "Could you love me?" And this was to make people think about those who are alone at Christmas. And in this episode, I chat to Mark about performance art and how he got started. We talk about things like creativity and self-expression, addiction, social media, connecting with music and all sorts of other things. We chat a lot about the Live Lounge exhibition that Mark is curating at the Bethlehem Gallery. That's on right now, up until July. And there's all sorts of amazing things going on. They've got workshops, they've got speakers, they've got the opportunity for people to go in and make their own artwork. And it's all themed around music and mental health. And it sounds really lovely. So we get into all of that in the episode. There's a link in the episode notes if you want to go and have a look and see what they're up to there. I've also put links in the episode notes to Mark's social media. So Mark uses his socials as a form of performance art. So if you're intrigued about Mark, if you'd like to know a bit more, then his social media channels are a really good way to kind of see what he's up to. There's also a link in the episode notes to his Etsy store where you can buy his artwork. And this is a really lovely conversation. To be quite honest with you, I wasn't quite sure what to expect when I logged on to chat to Mark. His artist taxi driver persona that he portrays on his socials is quite loud and quite ranty and almost confrontational. And I wasn't sure if he was going to be in character, so to speak, or whether he was going to be Mark. And we actually talk a little bit about that in the episode. Mark talks about how he doesn't always know where the artist taxi driver stops and Mark McGowan starts. So yeah, logging on, really had no idea what to expect. And I think I found Mark at the end of a very long day. He said that he was tired, but in a very reflective mode. And I was feeling a bit like that day as well. And we just ended up having this really sort of open and quite vulnerable conversation, really. Mark's been through a lot over the last year or so, and that was clearly on his mind. And it just was a really lovely conversation that just kind of drifts everywhere and goes off on tangents. And I think we both got a lot out of it. It felt like we both got a lot out of it. So yeah, it was lovely to chat to Mark. It was great to hear about his exhibition. That sounds fascinating. If you've listened to the show for long enough, you'll know I love stuff like that. I love stuff where we're just getting mental health out to the public, where people can just walk around and get involved and not be scared of it and take it out of the therapy room and out of the doctor's office. And I suppose show people that supporting your mental health doesn't have to look like one thing, or it doesn't have to be like this or like that. So it sounds incredible. I'm hoping to get down myself. I'm in London in June, end of June, I think. So I'm hoping to go and check it out myself. So yeah, that's all going on. Go and check that out. Huge thanks to Mark for coming on. Big thank you to Lucy Nickel for putting us in touch. And I hope you enjoy this conversation. If you'd like to watch me and Mark have this conversation, you can do so on the Patreon. I'm not going to push it this hard for this episode, actually, because we actually had some tech problems, which I can edit out in the audio, so you'd never know. But obviously, watching the video, you'd be quite clear that the audio drops in and out and we get a bit stuck here and there. Mark was actually driving around in his car while we recorded. So don't necessarily sign up to the Patreon to watch this one. But there's loads of other episodes up there, many of which haven't been released yet and aren't going to be released for a few weeks. There's also the videos for loads of them that don't go up anywhere else. And you can do things like submit questions to upcoming guests and just be part of the Proper Mental community that I've nicknamed the Proper Mentalists. And it's £3 a month. You can cancel at any time. And it just helps me keep the show ad-free and sponsor-free. Not that I'm particularly against any of that, because I think people need to get paid, right? But because of the nature of the conversations that I have, because of the depth and the challenging nature, I don't want to interrupt someone who's halfway through telling me a really vulnerable story. I don't want it to cut out to some ad. I don't want to cheapen the depths that we're trying to go to by selling you stuff, even though I'm trying to sell you this Patreon. So yeah, it just helps me to keep it taking over. Go and have a look, see what you think. You can have a nose around there before you sign up. Anyway, this is episode 183, The Proper Mental Podcast, with Mark McGowan, the artist taxi driver. Thank you very much for listening. Enjoy. So here we are with another episode of the Proper Mental Podcast. And my guest this week is Mark McGowan. How are you, mate?
I'm really good. How's yourself?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. Yeah, really good. Yeah, thank you. So you're on the, we're just saying before, you're on the road at the moment. So this is live and direct from the car, is it, mate?
Yes, it is. I'm paying attention to the road, though, not you.
Yeah, that's good. Probably for the best. Yeah, whether you're moving or not, but there we go. I thought probably like the best place for us to start today would be with yourself, mate. And you know, at the beginning, whereabouts are you from, Mark? Where did you grow up?
I'm from Peckham, Camberwell, southeast London.
And what was that like as an area to grow up in as a kid, mate? What was childhood like?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was brought up on the North Peckham estate. So that's like very like a 1970s. So it's a council estate. I suppose lots of people would be, you know, oh, council estates, this, that. I thought it was amazing. Best time ever. You know, growing up where you had a green area in the middle of the blocks, everyone played football, everyone was like, you know, everyone was out pre-phones, pre-like technology. So we only had sort of like balls in each other and running around, playing games. Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was an amazing space to grow up in.
That sounds really lovely. I think there's a, like, you know, it's interesting you say like without phones and stuff, there's so much to be said, not just for children, I suppose, for adults as well, for like being a bit bored. And I always found when I was a kid, you know, similar sort of deal, knocking about the estate, knocking about the park. And it was often like when we were really bored that some of the like the best, funnest ideas would come from, you know, and there's a lot to be said for that, isn't there?
I know. So they're talking, what's that? I saw a comedian do it the other day. Mindfulness. So, yeah, mindfulness for me growing up was staring at the window on the bus, watching the rain drip down. That was the comedian saying, like, you know, rather than sort of like just staring at your phone, not seeing the outside world and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably like an app where you can actually like download a drip that runs down your phone screen so you could watch to become more mindful or something, probably.
But I was actually talking about something similar to that today. We were saying, like, you know, when you were, I saw the Fat White Family the other day, like in a really tiny room, just doing this incredible performance, and it was all live. And it's really weird when, you know, when you're there, when you're experiencing it, it's unbelievable, you know, emotionally, you know, hairs on all your hairs sticking up. And it's so like, you know, just being there in this live event. And then when you go to show someone or when you post it online, it looks shit. It looks rubbish. Do you know what I mean? And people are like, no one likes it or no one says, but actually being there, it's like when you're on top of a mountain and it's like you're breathing in the oxygen and you're looking at the vista, you're looking around at snow peaks and just like valleys and lakes and you got a 360 view, and then you take a picture and show someone, it just doesn't mean anything, does it?
There's just no, there's not a camera in the world that can do it justice, right?
Yeah. No, but that's also like with, to do with like experiencing moments, you know, being present, being alive, you know, rather than like engaged in this game of isolation, you know, and it's almost like everyone wants you there, you know, the powers that be, the technologies, they all want you there. I mean, we're doing this thing live on Zoom, we're not even meeting, you know, we're kind of, I can only hear you, but they make it so much easier to for you to be isolated and alone rather than experiencing the presence of other people. It's extraordinary, really, how, you know, how things have changed.
Yeah, very much so. I think, as you know, because obviously we're like as humans, we're hardwired for connection. But then all these all this technology and, you know, all this stuff in society, it kind of, because it fakes that connection, then we all buy into it, right? So it's like we feel like we're getting the connection. It's like having a friend on Facebook and you feel like you're connected with them because you always know when they go on holiday or what they had for breakfast. But in reality, you've probably never spoken to them.
You've never even met them.
Such a strange thing. Yeah,
It's got to be damaging for people's mental health as well.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons, right? There's so many, I suppose, needs that you're not getting met that you think you are, and sometimes how it makes us behave. I think social media, in particular, is changing how we behave, like what is acceptable behavior, what is normal behavior. It's actually like changing the fabric of society, which is a bit worrying as well.
I know. One of the things that one of the really big changes that I notice it within myself, and I see it in my kids and family, is that the attention span, you know, because you have all this, scrolling and TikTok and things, Instagram, it's very quick, and it's like you've got an attention span of like 5-10 seconds is a really long time. Sometimes it's almost like a blink of an eye and you're scrolling again.
It's so true, isn't it? Yeah. Or if someone does a post with like quite a long caption and you read the first couple of lines and go, oh, this sounds brilliant, but I can't be asked reading all that. And in reality, it's probably about 200 words, you know, it's not even
there. And it's, you know, what it's doing, and what you're talking about changing human behaviours, but also sort of like physically and mentally, is creating an ADHD society. You know, with very little attention span. We used to be able to watch a film and barely a program, series, and then it's like, you know, now it's down to just nothing really, just, you know, endorphins, you know, like, so it's the best football goal, it's the best music, it's the most extraordinary kind of skateboarding, skiing, jumping, running.
Yeah, and I don't know, it's interesting as well, because, I mean, all these things are true, right? And these apps are built to manipulate us, and, you know, they're designed to hold our attention and to keep us online and doing all these things. But also, I'm always fascinated about where the line of responsibility lies, right? Because I know this, and yet I still allow myself to be a consumer of this stuff, right? So it's like, I don't know, somewhere out there, someone had to be the first person to take a picture of their coffee and post it online. And then instead of all of us saying, that's a stupid thing to do, I know what a coffee looks like, we all went, oh, fantastic, I'll take a picture of my coffee. And, you know, like, we all kind of do this, we all play the game. And it's one of the few things where we play the game, we know the game is rigged, we could opt out and we choose not to. There's a lot of things we can't opt out, but with social media, we could just fucking switch it off, right?
Yeah, I know. It's an addiction. It's all tested, and, you know, it's like Pringles crisps. You know, it's almost like they make the internet for you to consume. Like, where did they go? They went in a laboratory, they made a crisp that fits on your tongue. You know, it's not actually potato. It's like all these sort of flavorings, you know, to appeal to like your taste senses. It's just like that. They just make it to fit.
Yeah, it's a tricky, situation. So yeah, like we were saying, you know, with all that in mind, there is a lot to knocking about on the estate, and, you know, I don't know, seeing how far you can kick a Coke can down the road and all the daft stuff that me and my mates used to do. There's a lot to be said for that, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, there were simple times if you look back at like how things were, and then I'm sure, you know, the generations before got very nostalgic about those times, and just wondering what the nostalgia will be for people growing up today.
Yeah, that's a fascinating way to look at it. I've never really thought of that in the looking back perspective. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah.
Bean, you remember that time when we was on, what's it, Snapchat? We were all there together, because that's what they do. Everyone gets on Snapchat. You know, they're up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning. Have you done Snapchat? Have you been on Snapchat?
No, I've not. I think I'm too old, to be honest, Mark. I don't think I'm...
My God. You want to talk to these two in the car with me about Snapchat? Honest to God, right? So, I don't know, how many people can you get on Snapchat in one go?
When it's young.
You get as many people as you want in a group. all talking at the same time, all like laughing, joking. And they stay up till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. They make big groups, and then they exclude people from the group as well. So it's kind of like in the playground as well, isn't it? So like big groups of friends just hanging out. But it's till 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. That's why none of them get up to go to school.
I mean, that's to be honest, that makes me feel a bit anxious to even thinking about, online groups of that size. It sounds a bit cutthroat, like Game of Thrones or something, you know, excluding people from the group.
What, excluding people from the group?
Yeah, being able to like...
I know someone who does a bit of, they're like the editor of like a major place, and they were doing a documentary about flat earthers. So what they said to me was that they found out if you say anything about the flat earth, if you say, well, hang on a minute, if you even mention that, you get excluded from the Facebook group, like you're out of your ear straight away. But they were going like, that's the same if you say anything about any group. So even if you were talking about, like, you was in a group talking and you were all supporting Arsenal, and suddenly you went, you know, I don't think Tottenham was that bad this year, you're gone. Do you know what I mean? Or if it was about classic cars and you said something like, oh, I think I'm going to get a Tesla, you know, you're just gone. You'd be out of the group. So it's kind of like, you know, you have to toe the line in these groups. So I presume, like, the Snapchat's pretty similar.
Yes, but we're creating those echo chambers, right? Just that suit us and serve us, and I don't know. It's complicated stuff. It's complicated stuff. I always struggle with the whole like incongruence of it. You know, I'll moan about social media, and then I'll use social media, and there's nothing else in my life where I do that. You know, if I don't like something, I don't do it. If I'm like, you know, against something, I won't engage with it. But like social media, and I don't think that's good for us. We talk about a lot about like comparison and about getting likes and brain chemicals and all that. But I think just going through life and not liking something and still choosing to do it, the incongruence in that, I think is really bad for our mental health as well.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, but yeah, that's like taking drugs, isn't it? You know, it's bad. It's like alcoholism. You know, it's bad. But it's like, it's true. Like, so doing things that you know is bad for you, you know, within the sort of like mental health spectrum, like last year I ended up back at the Bromley Drug and Alcohol Unit, and I really wasn't well at all, and ended up going in there. It's not like the Priory, it's a walk in off the street. So there's a lot of street alcoholics, a lot of people. You know, in it's like a field hospital in a war zone. You've got bandaged heads, you've got tagged ankles, you've got people drinking hand sanitizer, desperate place. And like when you end up there, you are thinking, oh my God, why am I here again? But you don't, because you realize that you're in the struggle, you're in the grip of addiction and alcoholism. And it was just really, really tough because you don't know any way out. And sometimes you're feeling like, well, I don't actually want a way out. You know, it's kind of, you know, making art kind of saves me every time. But even making art wasn't saving me then. So I ended up like June till September, still going there, still drinking, but managed to do a detox in September and gone through lots of different therapy groups. And now I'm in like one-to-one therapy. But it's really tough, you know, it's tough being in this world and, you know, getting older, looking at your life, and losing perspective. And, you know, a lot of that's what the show's about as well. But a little one was there today. They were writing words on the wall of the exhibition. They said, no, you can't write those words. And it's like Billie Eilish words, lyrics. And it was really tough. And they kind of like, they said, no, it was quite apt, actually. They said, no, we're going to have to, is it okay if we paint over the words? But it's in the Bethlehem Gallery, and it's got like, you know, extraordinary stuff up there. It's in the museum. They've got like manacles, they've got padded cells. You know, you've got like an extraordinary painful exhibition up there. Alison Lapa, whose son Paris like committed suicide when he, like last year or the year before when he was 19. So it's like talking about things that trigger you, or like thinking about, oh, what safe space is. You know, it's really difficult. And it's like, it's funny because what you call this show, so it's kind of reclaiming these things. So when like someone writes Billie Eilish lyrics on the wall, and loads of Billie Eilish stuff is about like body dysmorphia, you know, teenage angst, depression, you know, suicidal thoughts, and lots of it's really real, you know, and it's like, it's how people feel. And we were talking there about the internet, but the underlying, a lot of that stuff is like, life's shit, you know, I'm not good enough, and it's like, and it's hard, and, you know, things, you know, the world looks shit at the moment with what's going on around the world in like fucking different places where, you know, looking at, you know, now news is filled up with things from Gaza, you know, little children hanging out of bloody buildings with arm, you know, just see an arm. And that's every day, you know, and then you got to go and confront or look at what's going on in your own life, you know, and sometimes that it's not that great, you know, not because of certain things, but also because, you know, you might be a little bit dysfunctional, or you might have like sort of like mental health stuff, you know, you might have like depression or, you know, food disorders or psychosis or any, you know, mental health doesn't, you know, it doesn't discriminate. It goes across all sort of like sectors of society. It's not, it just takes everyone, you know, same as drug addiction, alcoholism doesn't fuck around, you know, it'll go everywhere. And I think it's really tough for people to sort of like look at that and confront it. And then you're making art, you know, and it's sometimes it's so hard because it's like kind of incessant. It's every day, you know, and it's, yeah, it's tough, you know, and people going out trying to make like different things like music about, you know, what in a show, it's not all roses. You can't just like be all cutie and like say like, this is how things are. You know, and I don't even know, and I do like think about like, you know, is this a safe environment for some people, and is it triggering? And I do think that we have to, you know, 100%, we have to always be aware about crossing boundaries, other people's feelings, other people's emotions, you know, our behaviors around other people. But I do think there's sometimes when it's your stuff, you have to own it. You know what I mean? You really have to own it.
Yeah, I'm with you there 100%, Mark. You know, yes, exactly. We do have to kind of look out for people, right? And how they might receive stuff. But there's also a certain amount of like personal responsibility for people to, you know, protect themselves. And I think when we're talking about mental health, I always say to people, I speak to so many people who've got these like really challenging stories. I've got a challenging story, you know, and these stories are hard to listen to. And I always say, well, they should be fucking hard to listen to because they were hard to live. And we can't dumb that down. If we want to shine a light on these things and explore these things, we can't, like, you can't pull your punches and cut your corners because it's people's reality, right? It's the day-to-day reality of life. And there's no point pretending that it's not everything that it is. You know, it's like, that's an important thing. It takes away the shame. People feel shame, don't they, about these things? And if we don't, like you say, own it and step into it and talk about all the fucking horrible bits, then, you know, that it just creates this really murky space where no one's getting seen and no one's able to speak openly. So yeah, it's important, man, warts and all, isn't it, the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because some people have to have the responsibility of saying what's okay and what's not okay, and sometimes spaces belong to other people, so it's up to them what goes into the space. But
I do
get all that, but yeah, the little one, like, so she only felt, and she wrote the words on the wall today in the gallery for this exhibition. Then they said, oh, we're gonna paint over it. I said, is that all right? I said, can you write some happy Billie Eilish words? She says, I'm not sure there's that many, but it's yeah, she said, oh, yeah, tell them to paint over it, but I'm not going back. But I think it's like, you know, it's tough stuff, you know, writing or feeling and, you know, how we express ourselves. And words are powerful, you know, words are really, really powerful.
Yeah, particularly with music, isn't it? And that connection to music sometimes, like, I don't know, other people's, with music, you borrow other people's words, right? You can't put into a sentence how you're feeling, but maybe Billie Eilish can, you know, maybe she can sum it up for you, you know, and that's, I suppose, why we, why we like music.
Music's so powerful as well. So I'm a performance artist, done lots of painting, done lots of different things, but I've really thrown myself into this exhibition over the last sort of like 6 months, and you know, started making music and looking at different so like mental health aspects of music. What you know, we're sung lullabies when we're born, and we pick our music for our own funerals if we got time. No, if we're given that time, you can pick your own music, or people pick them. So it's cradle to the grave stuff. But when you're alive, it has so much emotional stuff. So whether it's falling in love, you know, music's there and it sort of like makes you, you know, makes you glow, or whether it's you know, breaking up, music's there and it's sort of like it probably reinforces the pain sometimes, you know, makes you very tearful. You know, songs about loved ones that are part, you know, songs are written about every sort of like aspect of human kind of characteristics and sort of like day-to-day happenings and everything that goes on in your life, all caught up in a song. You know, lots of songs are, you know, music's very tribal. You've got like mods and rockers or those sort of like different, you know, people don't talk to each other if they don't belong to the same sort of like music group, or you know, and then it's people that it has so much to do with identity, you know, like whether you're Kurdish and you listen to a traditional Kurdish, or whether you're Irish and listen to traditional Irish music, you know, we all have this. And then cultures sort of like, I often engage in conversations around, so like people, and I will talk about singers and songwriters and songs that I know of that place, you know. So I think there's always, there's so much going on. I think music's like, if you go to YouTube, music's like number one. Like all the top videos ever watched over the billions are all music videos. You know, creatively is probably maybe gaming, but like gaming's another thing. But like, possibly like music's like the number one thing that, you know, people is engage with, you know, creative practice.
It's always been important for humans as well. So not only like cradle to the grave in our lifetime, but from the, you know, when they trace back the history of human beings, you know, there's always been an element, haven't it? Whether it was like banging sticks on trees or whatever, but it's always been important to culture in, you know, in every form of human beings. Yeah, it's an incredible thing. It's a powerful thing. Yeah.
Yeah, primal scream.
Yeah, very much so. What's tell me about the exhibition then, Mark. So what's going on? Because we've kind of got in there a little bit, but what are people going to see? What's it all about?
So you come through a curtain. It's like you walk into the big main building in Bethlehem and there's a curtain. You come into a curtain. On your left is like Mr. X, Keith. He's built a spaceship, but it's like really, it's a ticket booth. We've got a stage. We've got banners everywhere. We've got rugs. We've got sofas. We've got boxes, musical instruments, double basses, synthesizers. We've got speakers everywhere. Basically, what I wanted is live lounge. And they told me not to use this word, but I wanted to create like a squat-like environment where people could just come out, put their feet up. You know, Bethlehem's down it's in Beckenham. You can get the bus from Bromley South. Like Victoria's 15 minutes away and the bus is 10 minutes. It's really easy to get to, but it's always seems like quite a journey for a lot of people. I think they should give badges to people when they come through the door and a clap. Sort of like, you know, in like, well done for making it here, because it's far to get to. But I wanted to create space where people can come and hang out. So there's nothing in the space apart from like musical instruments and you can jam, and like there's guitars, and you know, why just let the people come and make the music, let the people come and create, let the people come and make art and dance and sing. And so the space is open like for until the 13th of July. It should be amazing. Alan Bajur, who's like an event theorist I studied at Goldsmiths, he said any attempt to preempt an event is foolish. So you never quite know what's going to happen. You know, anything can happen. You set it up so you can talk about it before the event. Things happen during the event, and you know, the narrative exists after the event. But we've got lots of good people coming down, but we've got lots of people who are, you know, incredible artists, incredible musicians who are all going to perform. We've got lots of really good stuff going on. We've got like a film, a music film club every Thursday. We've got Martin Ware from Heaven 17, Human League, coming down doing a workshop on with synthesizers and 30 top tips to make a hit song. You know, it's going to be really exciting. Hopefully, like, you know, I just like, we've already got sofas in there. You know, I just want to turn up to a gallery where everyone just lounges around. Do you know what I mean? And plays music. So we've got some decks there. I mean, hopefully people come to, like, you know, not just to listen to music, but make music. So we made an album. So I did sort of like some recordings of people from the Bethlehem community. And then took those recordings, and then Gowan Hewitt, who's a producer, he made, like, we did it, we recorded live in the workshop at the Bethlehem, and it was really cool, really, really super cool. And he used sort of like, you know, landscape kind of like music, and made some of it might sound weird. It did come out like, so it's a double A-side album, so it's gone off to be pressed. Hopefully be back. He's like, the guys reckon, because it's on vinyl and everyone's coming out the woodwork, like making vinyl. So not only have you got Taylor Swift and, you know, Billie Eilish, like making vinyl now, all the big artists, every single album, they're remaking it on vinyl. You know, everyone's going like mad to get out vinyl. So vinyl's really hard to... I think my lot's gone, or our ones are coming from Czechoslovakia, you know, but everyone's like, you know, big bands like Queen, or I don't know, if you go into, like, there's all these shops now and online selling vinyl of like records that were made like 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, like reissuing it brand new on vinyl. So everyone likes listening. And it's true, because that, going back to what we said at the beginning about seeing things live. You know, when I listen to music on Spotify and Apple, and it has its own place and it has its own time, but I always find it quite vacuous. You know, there's this kind of hollow sound, you know, and life's got scratches in it. So where's your static? Where's your, you know, whenever you put the needle on the record, it just starts and you've already heard it, even when you switch it on. You know, and then you hear this, the grainy bit at the beginning as it's whirling around. It's like magic. It's like magic. And you actually see it, and everyone, you know, kids are going, look at that. And they're just like following it like cats. Do you know what I mean? Looking at it going round and round. On Instagram, I saw the other day, right, some artist, and it's like, this must be so painful for people watching. So what they've done, they've got a record player, and it filled the record player with gravel, right, and they put the needle on it, and it's going around. The noise is horrific, and they've got it really amplified, but it's just going around, bouncing up and down on this sort of, like, because it's quite big gravel, you know. I don't know what the gravel points are for, like, gravel stones, but they're not those tiny little pebble ones. These are like quite chunky. It was really mad as well. I really liked it. I'm interested in alternative sound. I'm interested in analog sound. I'm interested in sort of like sounds in nature. The other day I was on the tube, and, you know, if you've ever been on a tube, you know, when you go through one bit and it goes like deafening. I mean, deafening. You know, when you go through that bit, because I got a sample on my iPhone now, and I just press the sample to get this deafening sound. And then you get home and you can slow it down. It sounds incredible. Yeah, or you go into nature, just like into the woods, or, you know, you can chatter in a coffee place, you know, anywhere. It's so amazing. I love sampling sounds. But also, we've got, like, once a week, we're doing sound safari where we go out. So you can make, I can make a record in like 2 minutes, 3 minutes. I can record all these sounds, put them into my sample machine, press the button, play them. They start playing in a rhythm, in a routine, set the, like, BMP or RPM, whatever it's called, and then it just comes out. I don't even know how it works. You can put a vocoder over it. You can put like you distort your voice. You can put, and then just log it all on, and it's made in like minutes. You can make like a jingle, like set, it doesn't even take long at all. A minute, 2 minutes, you made it. Yeah. I love it, all the new stuff, the new technologies. But I'm really, if you go on into Instagram, there's some people on there. If you follow one, they'll all follow, you know, like because the algorithm's got you. So if you watch one, you'll get another one.
Yeah.
And I watched this one by like French guy called Steganor, out on top of a mountain or out down by a lake or like just at home with like reel to reels and stopping them and just like creating very slow, very calming ambient sounds, you know, which I find incredible. But yeah, again, they're all 45 seconds. You know, I don't know whether I could listen to a whole track of it. So you just get a clip and then it's gone. And then there's another one and another one and another one. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it, what's out there and what people do. Where, how did you start getting interested in art and music and those sorts of stuff, Mark?
If in we the rewind mental a little hospital.
Bit. In is the that mental right? Hospital. Yeah.
Yeah. So back in the day, so grew up in Peckham on a housing estate, ended up football hooligan, went to like raves and things and got into ecstasy, heroin. So ended up like on heroin for like, I was on a methadone script for ages. I was at the Maudsley for ages with a really good doctor, Dr. Michael Farrell, who's a top guy. He's like one of the top addiction doctors. But I ended up in the Bethlehem, which is where I am now. And when I was there in like 96, 97, around that time, they were celebrating their 750 years and they had opened a little gallery space and they put me in the first show there. So I've been there as long as the gallery's been there. So I was there like doing on the Wickham Park House, and then I was there a couple of times and then ended up in a place in Clapham, Thurston House. But in the Bethlehem, they was going, oh, you should go, you should make art, you're really good at art. And then I ended up in the Thurston House for 6, 9 months, can't remember. And they were going, there was lots of art therapy. And I went straight from there to Camberwell to like do like to do art. Like, I was about 37 by then. And then they just like got into a course there. And yeah, I couldn't believe it. It's like, so I was making this art and then like, you know, Brit art, Damien Hirst and Tracy Emin, it was very popular, you know, it's quite populist kind of stuff. But I was like mad smackhead from Peckham and they say, oh, you can do whatever you want, framed within an art context. Everything's allowed. So I started doing all these kind of like performance things. I was doing interventions into the media. So I pushed a monkey nut, a peanut along the road with my nose for 7 miles. Have you seen all that work?
I've read about it, yeah, in the prep for this, yeah. So,
yeah, I did about 100 performances, like street performances. They were like a joy. It was so cool. So, yeah, I was on the telly all the time, on the news, on Richard and Judy, Loose Lips, yeah, just going around making art, just fucking around, really. And all I wanted to do was like get in the newspaper, get on the telly. That was number one priority, you know, and reclaim the work. You know, I had a small corgi dog, you know, left the tap running for a year, like wasting like 800 million litres of water. But anything, and like most of it existed around the narrative. We was just talking about that little about event theory, but Peggy Phelan, so she's this performance theorist, and she says, like within an art context, she says the power of performance lies in it not really being there. So what she's talking about is like, so you have like painting, sculpture, which are quite tangible objects, and performances, obviously it's time-based kind of media, you know. So she's saying that the power of performance lies in it not really being there. And what I think she's talking about is narrative. So the narrative exists before, during, and after an event. Before the event happens, I could say anything. I'd say, I'm going to eat a small corgi dog because Prince Philip like beat a fox to death with his stick. And I'd have all this narrative. And it go in the papers. So it already exists. It exists as an idea, but It exists as a news story. The event's not even happened. And if you've ever witnessed any performance art, to be fair, a lot of it's not that great. Do you know what I mean? So when I was crawling along, you know, you'd witness me just, I'd be going along this street here, mainly interventions with children, alcoholics, you know, no one's going to like, I crawled from London Bridge to Canterbury with 28 boxes of chocolates tied around my wrists and ankle. I had a rose between my teeth and a big sign on my back saying, could you love me? You know, it went on for weeks and I was just crawling along. So you had all these kind of like meetings with people, but witness live and you got stories and everything. But that's the narrative during the event. The narrative after the event is like, you can say anything. You've got all the sort of like TV news media, you've got your news clips, you've got your newspaper cuttings, you've got your stories, you've got how you want to describe it all on the internet. So it's really interesting, this power of narrative, you know, and what I said, like being this mad smackhead from Peckham, suddenly like you can do whatever you want. And your biggest tool, like when you're out there using, is fucking lying, do you know what I mean? So you just can say anything, or just this imagination, this kind of like, you know, just, you know, I really loved like taking trips and things like that and exit, but really getting off my head. And I was, you just think of the maddest thing you ever want to think, and it becomes an art project, do you know what I mean? And then you think about a few props, and it's just extraordinary art, really. You know, and it's a real privilege being an artist. It's so privileged, you know, because you get to frame it. You know, most people don't even, like, because there's so many people on the internet, you're just somebody else on the internet these days. But, you know, it's a critical fine art practice. And, yeah, it's difficult sometimes. It's not always that easy because the world, everyone goes, like, someone does something stupid and go, oh, is that a bit of a performance art? And they're like, fucking, why is it, or why do we always get it? Do you know what I mean? Why is it all, why are you always saying, oh, is it my community? You know, because performance art in an art, in the art world is a bit of a novelty. It's almost, we're like the lava lamp. Do you know what I mean? Just like they say if you're a performance artist, they say, oh, we got closing on Sunday. Do you think you could come and do a performance? Do you know what I mean? And you go there, no one takes a blind bit of notice of you. Everyone's in a room, like, drinking or looking. They're not even looking at the paintings. So they just turn up. You're there trying to be all serious. But that's why I like taking my art out onto the streets as well. Taxi driver, this taxi driver thing, this is all, like, people say, like, oh, are you really a taxi driver? No one says, oh, are you really an artist? You know what I mean? They just think, you know. But it's you know, this is a prop. These glasses are a prop. I must admit, these are new glasses. First glasses I've had in 14 years. My old glasses I had for 14 years. I just bought these ones this year. But they're a prop. And it's hard sometimes. And, you know, like, because with my therapist, because, you know, you kind of, like, confiding in your therapist, you're telling them everything, and because you get lost, because I don't know where Mark McGowan is and where the artist taxi driver is, because there's so much playing this character, you know, being at the Bethlehem today, people call you, hey, taxi driver, or like going into the, you know, making art most of the time, you know, probably just with the family, mum. If I go sit with mum, maybe mum's got Alzheimer's and dementia. I play her Luke Kelly, you know, the Dubliner, Spurts of Memory, and, you know, yeah, all that stuff's tough, you know. The dementia's like, they say that you just die like thousands of times. You're just dying over and over and over again. So it's really painful to witness it. And, you know, mum being very apologetic, saying sorry a lot. You know, because she forgets things, and it's really tough stuff. And I'm sure loads of people listening to this, you know, people have, you know, it's touched everyone. But music's really good. Music's really comforting. I often put the music on for her to listen to.
Oh, that's a really lovely thing. A really lovely thing to be able to do. Yeah, to use music in that way.
Yeah, I did a spoken word thing. There's a place down in Camberwell It's an old bus inspector shelter that someone's taken over and turned into sort of like a street gallery. There's no door on it. It's just like this kind of cube thing in the middle of the pavement. But yeah, and I did a spoken word thing down there. I wrote a poem called What's Going to Happen to All My Stuff When I Die, which is a poem written around a question that my mum asked. And it's really sad, you know, and it's a great poem. I really like writing poetry. I like writing spoken word, and I always write in my own voice, you know. I never tried to make it so it sounds something different, you know. I always struggled with that, you know, and I think people do when you're writing stuff, when you're trying to write music, you know, lyrics, or whether you're writing poetry or spoken words, you always try and put on this kind of like, not airs and grace, but to try and fit in what you think it should sound like. And you should just be yourself. You know, you should just like write words, you know, how you talk, how you speak, just write your truth, you know, and it all comes out, and it sounds so good as well. And it, you know, people get, I like it anyway. Spoken word's great.
Yeah, it's a powerful thing. Yeah, really, you can really feel it. I really feel it. I'm always interested, Mark, in the link between creativity and creative people and mental ill health. And I can never quite find the words to ask this question, right? But there seems to be a link. Like, if you want to create stuff, if you want to make all the art that you want to make, then you have to be able to like tap into a certain part of yourself. You have to be able to really like feel things and express that. But then at the same time, you know, we're talking about like the state of the world and how hard it is to go around and feel the weight of that and the impact that it has. And it kind of feels like to almost to be able to tap into the creativity, you have to open yourself up to all this stuff that's not very nice to, do you know what I mean? I'm not quite sure what I'm saying with that, Mark. I can't quite find the word for the questions, but...
Yeah, and I suppose that's why there's lots of like music therapy, art therapy, dance therapy, you know. It's seen as a like a gateway into the mind, you know, like, so being creative is a certain part because you have all these different sort of like things going on in your head. So like, where's that creative kind of like place in your head, and how close is it to the sort of like states of sort of like melancholy or states of madness that are there? How close is that to, you know, because we make music in different, I was talking about like making whether you can change people's feeling emotionally by listening to music. And if you played someone calming music, well, the fact is what calms people, some people down, is like rage music or loud music or things that like just go off, you know? And for some people, that's like their sort of like way to calming down, or their way to sort of, that's how they enjoy music. No, it doesn't always have to be sort of like, you know, melancholic. Sometimes it can just be, yeah. I mean, I like all the creative sort of like aspects of my sort of like addiction and my madness, you know, it really fits with it. So, yeah, I remember a tutor telling me, like, after I'd done like, I don't know, 500 paintings, going like, well, this really isn't an art practice. It's an addiction, what you're doing. Which I kind of get. And I was like, yeah, so I don't use drugs. I just do paintings. Yeah, that's why I do it. But it is, you know, you can't, you know, making, I was talking the other day as well about this, right? So making art and making something really incredible. So lots of, and I've told my students, lots of students over the years, like, so when you're making art, you always have a starting point. It can be like on a theme, like you're in this show and like it's a nature show or climate change or something, like make a piece of work about that. Or it can be like media led, like I'm going to make a sculpture, I'm going to do paintings on cardboard, I'm going to do paintings on canvas. So we always get like these starting points, or I'm going to make music about, I'm going to make a trance music, I'm going to make dance music, I'm going to make like a, I'm going to do a spoken word. So you can always think about starting points, and it can be mediums, it can be context and all things. I always say, right, your starting point should be, I'm going to make something absolutely fucking extraordinary. I'm going to make something that's going to make people laugh, make people cry. You're going to have to pick them up. You know, what you want to do is you want to make, like, you want to have a starting point of extraordinary. So however far you get down, you know, I'm all into like making series and things like that. But we got on, you got to think, I'm going to make the best ever, you know, painting of a tree. I just think that, like, sometimes we're just going along, just making work, and you know, maybe we don't always access that kind of like mental stuff that's going on. Sometimes it can be like making art can be very mundane. You just do, you know, you get into that part of your practice where it's just very repetitive and maybe cathartic or whatever, but it's not like punching, it's not fucking full on, you know. It's not, you're not standing up, you're not trying to make something extraordinary. And being things like artists and painters and that, you know, it's a tough thing. You know, you're up against Rembrandt and Picasso, because those guys are still around, they're still hanging on the walls. So you got to go and make something even better than that. You know, I think there is too much repetitive stuff. There's too much derivative stuff. You can see someone's gone, no, look, every idea has already been done. Everyone knows that. It's just like trying to put you in the middle. So that's why, like, you know, if you want to do a PhD in sort of like in art practice, PhD is all about like new stuff, or like, you know, researching something new. That new is always you. You know, it's always you. That's the important thing. It's who you are, how you express. But again, you know, yeah, we're just the same as everybody else. Done that Deleuze and guitar. What was it? Difference and repetition. So it's almost like, you know, there's, I don't know, I can see your door. You know, it's probably like, what, 10 doors in your house? You know, they're probably like, could all be even the same door, the same painted door.
Pretty much.
Yeah, but they're 10 different doors. Do you know what I mean? So their idea of difference and repetition, they're all the same, but they're different. You know, one of them, like one of your kids might scratch their name on it, or you might do the height thing on like a door. You know, so the same as like the bus there, when you come past the bus, there's 4 tires on that bus. But they're all different, but there's like 20 people on the bus. They're all people, but they're all the same, but they're different. You know, and that difference in repetition is like, that's the key to sort of like understanding everything. Like, I'm not saying you get enlightened by it, but like that is really true. Difference in repetition. So we're the same as like people making art 1,000 years ago, you know. People loving 1,000 years ago, people crying 1,000 years ago. No, we're all, this is all the same stuff. It's just how, what mark do you want to put on it? I remember like Phil Amy, one of my tutors, he would say like, Michelangelo, he's dead, Turner, dead, you know, Picasso, dead, Andy Warhol, dead. Now it's your turn. What are you going to do? Oh, Phil Amy, he's probably dead now. He was old enough then.
Is it, when you were talking about the performance stuff before, mate, and it made me think of it as well when you were talking about a starting point. Like, there's a real like freedom, right, for you, like having this idea and saying, right, I'm going to crawl for X amount of miles and push a peanut and all that, and just that freedom to just have an idea and follow it through. And like, I think as humans, modern society, we're all really like repressed, right? And so you look from a starting point of art point of view, a lot of people, and I'd include myself in this, if you said I want to do art, and they'd be like, well, how? And you go, well, here's a pen and a pad. It's like, well, what do I do? How do I draw? What should it be? And like, even getting started is hard. And it, and you know, I think that's good for mental health, is to find a way to be free, to be freer. Does that make sense? To just be able to like, just let fucking go a little bit and let something out and see what happens. There's a magic in that, but we find it hard, I think, as a society to do it. I don't know what your thoughts on that are.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that, like, you know, the idea of, you know, when I said it's really privileged being the artist, and it's true, the idea of wanting to make art and then, so there's it's great and it's a curse. So if you're just a practicing artist, you got to wake up every single day and think, what am I going to do? What am I going to make? What am I going to paint? What am I going to create? Whereas if you're kind of like working like in illustration or graphics or with a media company, you know, making, you know, film, make someone, you've got a job. So it's so hard, you know, trying to work out every single day. You know, you're only driven by your own stuff. You know, you're only, you know, it's not easy at all. It's not easy because, like, you feel like, yeah, I have to wake up and think of making something new, something different. Something new, something different in a world where, you know, people have completely lost their sense of wonder. You know, just no one's got any wonder at all. They just can't. Yeah, I remember this guy telling the story, and it's about, yeah, so he's going for a job. There's a theatrical agent. So he goes up. It's on the 17th floor, and your man's at the desk, and the guy walks into the room, and he's on the phone, and he kind of, like, nods to him and say, go on in. And the guy, like, you know, do your bit, perform, whatever. So the guy takes a run and goes for the window and goes straight through the window, loops the loop around the entire building, comes back in the opposite window. And as he comes through, he does this massive roll of star jumps on one big, like he does a triple pirouette and lands straight down on the splits in front of the guy, straight across his desk. And the theatrical agent says to him, what else can you do? You know, because no one's, everyone's lost this sense of wonder, you know, that nothing surprises people. And, you know, maybe like it's going to get even worse with TikTok because everyone's seen everything, you know, visually. Or, you know, what's really interesting, if you go on the Red London bus and you get it south side and you go over, like, say, Westminster Bridge, and you've got a load of tourists upstairs, maybe Japanese tourists, who are sitting at the front of the bus with the big window like that. Have a look at their faces going over, having a look at Big Ben. Do you know what I mean? It's like you can see, like, some people, you know, it's difficult to have that sense of wonder, isn't it? Do you get that? You know, how, you know, you have to take a breath. Or, and we were talking about that earlier, wasn't we? About going out and, like, standing on the mountain or being alive or being present. Or they want you, they want you nailed down. They want you, you know, they don't want you in love. They don't want you. That's why they have, like, pornography so successful. Do you know what I mean? Because they rather have that you attached to that. That's why it's so addictive, rather than being in a relationship or rather than being in a thing, you know, with someone. You know, they get you every single way. And it's, yeah, I do think that it's, you know, personal awareness, or, you know, therapy is really good. Therapy is great for, like, trying to kind of, you know, understand when you're, when you feel like human emotions like shame, or when you're, when you feel like greedy or greed, you know, or when you feel, you know, jealousy, you know, because some of these feelings, they consume you. You know, as an addict, I know about this stuff. You know, they, some of these feelings, shame or jealousy, they start at your toes, they come up your legs, then your body's racked with it. If you can't identify what is physically happening, like, other things manifest in your, in your behaviors, in your feeling. You know, imagine you're just going around, you're this swelling, vibrant, you know, being that does, that's got all this emotion going on because of whatever's happened. But if you knew that, if you knew, you go, oh, this is because I'm feeling jealous. You know, it just switches off straight away. It's acknowledging what you're feeling, you know, like, you know, maybe embracing that, embracing the feeling of shame, you know, and when you're really angry with someone, or when you're impatient, you know, when you're really impatient, when you can't bear someone and they're really impatient and you're so impatient with them, or, you know, you should, imagine you said to yourself, and I should be grateful for this, you know, because they're teaching me here. They're teaching me, like, how to be more tolerant. had to be more patient, you know, and you respect that. You go, oh, nice one, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't change how, you know, there's that sort of like powerlessness over other people. So you can't change all that stuff, you know. So people are just going to be, and it's you're, but you do that to yourself as well. So you have like unrealistic demands on other people, and you play all those scenarios through your head. You also have unrealistic demands on yourself, you know, and like, why didn't I do this? Why didn't I do that? And we're all human, you know, everyone makes mistakes. Everyone sort of like does different things at different times. It's acknowledging that in other people as well, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it helps us to find like compassion for ourselves, right? You know,
yeah.
I always say when I wasn't well, and I would get very angry, and I didn't like people, and I would radiate that out. And it was because I was cross and confused with myself, and I'd blame other people for it. And when I found compassion for myself, I was able to find compassion for other people, you know, and all of that stopped. All of the outward stuff stopped when I made peace with myself. But you know what you were saying there about emotions is we put these labels of emotions being good or bad, right? So if you feel jealousy, we're taught that that's a bad emotion. There's no bad emotions, but we're taught that jealousy is a bad thing to feel. So then because we felt jealous, then we attach some shame to it. So that's another supposedly bad emotion. And then these things get out of control, don't they? When in reality, you're like, feeling jealous for a bit is fine. And like you say, you acknowledge it and let it pass and just get back on with your day, right?
Yeah. And if you do like, because I like drugs, or, you know, but I'm not allowed to have them, but, you know, I like changing the way I feel. So if you do feel jealousy, if you do feel shame, wow, I feel that's incredible. You know, that's really, really cool. Listen to this, right? So back when I was drinking last year, I was like so much bottles of wine. I put on so much weight, like 101 kilos. So when I stopped like up at the thing, I decided to go on the keto diet. So stop all carbs. So all my life I had like bread, potatoes, rice every day. So first day, you know, like when you get really weak in the morning, sometimes when you haven't had your breakfast. And I was like thinking, oh my God, how long can I do this? Because I'd been eating, you know, I was having eggs and spinach. But because you're not having the carbs, your body goes into like almost like a fucking crisis. You know, you're getting that really sort of like, I was holding onto the thing, onto the banister, trying to go up the stairs. I was getting all dizzy in the doorway. I was going, I've got to sit down for a minute. I was getting back up. I was going, oh my God, this is amazing. I felt like I was completely off my nuts, but it was like how I'd never felt before. It was a new experience, you know, it was just lightheadedness for days. It went on for 3-4 days, and about day four, when all the carbs are gone, your body kicks into what they call like that ketosis thing, and it's you start getting really mad energy, like you think you're invincible, like you can run through a wall. It's almost like I felt like Popeye, you know, like the guy who eats the spinach. I felt like Popeye, felt so super strong. Yeah, I started playing football. I know, like, I'm 60 this year. I'm 60 in about a month. And, playing football. I was playing football last night. All young kids, you know, in their 20s and that, running around. Yeah, I love it. It's good fun.
Yeah. That's, you know, I don't know, you mentioned age there, and it is something we, I was talking about this with someone the other day, you know, and these horrible statistics around men's mental health and men of a certain age brackets are, you know, more likely to die by suicide and all that stuff. And a huge part of that, I think, is that as we get to these certain milestones in life, we stop doing stuff that we enjoy, like playing football. And that's one of the things that, you know, life's pretty hard. We have to do loads of shit that we don't want to do. And you kind of have to do it because you've got to pay a mortgage and look after, you know, your house and your kids and all the rest of it. And we stop doing all the fun stuff. And I'm sure that that is a part of it, is not playing football or making art or baking or doing whatever it is, the thing that people enjoy, is these are the things that we put down as we journey through life. And that's got to have an impact, I think, on the overall state of men's mental health. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, men's mental health and sort of like men's stuff, I don't know how much I've tapped into that. You know, I'm not sure I've done too much work on that or what that even means. Probably should do. I know there's a whole sort of like, I suppose most of the work I've done is like on addiction or addictive behaviors and things like that. Yeah, men's mental health, something else, isn't it? And suicide and everything. Yeah, it's tough stuff. Like, I was proper suicidal last year. I should look into it. My therapist is female as well. I should maybe prompt her and ask her about that. See what that is. See what that means. Yeah, and I think it is feeling less than. It's feeling sort of like all those sort of like stuff that society puts on you as a man, and like what that means, you know, what it means to like, you know, my family than that, even work, you know, if you say you're an artist, you know, the only way that you'd be like the only work they consider is like digging roads. They're all Irish, you know. So if you could dig a hole, that's it. That's proper work. Or build a house or put on a roof or, you know, mix a thing of cement. Yeah. Like being an artist, that was just not.
I can well imagine,
Yeah, it's
yeah,
tough
very
because
much
it's
so.
like you got all that sort of like, you know, male testosterone, sort of like you got to be a geezer and that. Like most of all my family's South London, very kind of like entrenched in it is patriarchy, but it's like also just like too much. Some of it on financial stuff and all that stuff. I struggle with all of that actually. It's always a problem. Finance, debt. Kind of like, you know, I bet I like even growing up, I didn't even understand. I could do, couldn't even work out how to like manage or even believe that you could run a house. Do you know what I mean? Or what that even meant. It was so hard. But I was such a hedonist. Do you know what I mean? I was more like out on a beach somewhere, you know, didn't really want to sort of like engage, wanted to live in an alternative society. But they don't want you out there anyway. They don't want people living in alternative society. They don't want people off grid, or that's why they shut down things like squats or anyone that does anything. I think it was like who was those guys that went up on the hill back in the Roundhead days? What were they called? The diggers. Is it the
Right,
diggers?
I don't know.
So yeah, they took a piece of common land. What was his name? Was it Win Stanley? His name's
Right.
Win Stanley. So yeah, took a piece of common land. And then they were down the bottom, and they were going, "What's going on up there?" It was like the local police, but they weren't police; they were like the judiciary. Go up, send the roundheads up there. Go and ask them what they're doing. So they went up there, and they said, "Oh no, we've taken this bit of common land, and we're going to have our own community up here. We're going to just like look after ourselves, you know, no taxes or anything to the king." Or yeah, so they just sent the roundheads up there and just like dismantled the camp. That's kind of like how things are now. You have to be inside the system, you know, you have to be really captured. You know, there's a lot of safety and security in the system and everything like that. And everyone kind of uses the system for sort of like health and education and everything like that. But, you know, alternative ways of living are just non-existent. Well, they aren't. You know, some people do it. But like homeschooling's become a really big thing, isn't it? It's quite a big thing.
Like you say, no, the system's designed to keep us in. I interviewed a guy called Rory O'Connor. He's a professor from Glasgow Uni, and he's works in their like suicide research department. He's been researching suicide for 25 years. He wrote this amazing book called When It's Darkest. And something that he talked about to me that has always stuck with me when he's looking at causality for suicides. And he said he talked about the everydayness of people who die by suicide. It's not the big things, it's the small things. It's the everydayness, the debt, the state of the world, the turning on the news, the rowing with a partner, the shitty job. It's these things that get heavier and heavier and heavier until you can't carry them anymore. And that landed with me. I was like, that made so much fucking sense to me, you know, just like
I get
every,
that as well.
the
I
start.
always used to use, and it'd be like you break your shoelace, and that'd be it. You know, your shoelace is broke on your only pair of shoes, or something like that, and you just go, oh, fuck it.
And it, you know, in reality, it's not the shoelaces, it's everything that happened before the shoelace, and the shoelace is the final, the straw in the camel's back or whatever it is.
Probably the fact that you've only got one pair of shoes.
Probably doesn't help. Oh mate, Mark, I'm gonna let you go. I've had you for ages tonight. I don't know where that went. We just like got
That's
all the
very
way
nice
into it then.
talking with you.
Oh mate, I love chatting to you too. Yeah, it's a real pleasure to meet you. And I'll make sure the links to the exhibition are in the episode notes. But like you say, it's kicking off next week, 7th of May, and that's through till July, right? So people have got
Yeah,
plenty of time to
30th
get
of
down there.
July. Yeah, you've got loads
Yeah.
of time to get down there.
Mate, well, yeah, it sounds wonderful. It sounds like a really cool thing, and I wish you all the best of it, mate, and all the best of everything. I hope it, hope it, hope it, all of it goes well. I hope everything's good.
Yeah. Where are you based then?
So I live near Liverpool. I'm on the Wirral.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, up that way. So yeah, I'm from Wales originally, but I've lived around here for my wife's from here, so I moved here like 10, 12
Yeah.
years ago, and been here ever since. So, and it's like once you have kids, it's home then, so it's home for me
Yeah.
now. But
I was up
yeah.
there, like I was up there with the Dockers in Liverpool a while ago, or last year was it? Yeah, they was out on strike, so I went up and I was covering them out on strike.
Right,
Proper series up there. Looked great, and they won as well, which was really good.
yeah. I mean, Merseyside and Liverpool's like, I love that side of it. It's such a, it's a Liverpool's a city that, I don't know, the people there really support each other and they do things on their own terms. And
Yeah.
everyone's a socialist and big social justice element. And
Yeah, definitely.
it's nice. Yeah, it's nice. Definitely, very much so. All right,
Hey,
mate.
lovely talking to you
Yeah,
then.
you too, Mike. Thank you for your time, mate. It's great to
No
meet you. And
worries, no worries.
I'll drop you an email or a message or something. I'll follow you on Instagram. I'll drop you a message when it's coming out. It'll be in the next week or two. And yeah, and all the best of it, mate. Hope it goes well.
Fantastic, amazing. What's your thing on Instagram then? Do I follow you?
I don't think so. No, I follow you. It's I'm at Proper Mental Podcast. So
Okay, let me have a
nice and
look.
easy.
Oh yeah, I've got you now. I'm following you now. Tom
Wonderful.
Davies.
That's me, mate.
Proper
That's me.
mental.
Yeah.
Proper mental.
Mate, I'll let you go.
Hey,
And
nice one, Tom.
yeah, lovely to
Fantastic.
meet you, mate. Take
Hey,
it
nice
easy, yeah.
meeting you too. You
Ta-ra
too.
now.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Big up to the Proper Mental Podcast. A proper mental podcast.